I want to change this. A lot of people don't realize the recency also requires night takeoffs. So I think we should change this to ask, are you takeoff current?
That's good. Yeah. Takeoffs and landings is what it says. That's very true.
That's right. Are you night takeoff current?
We've got so many shirts we need to make.
Are you night takeoff current? I like that one.
That'd be a great opening line for Bumble. I think that maybe there, that's where you go.
How many night takeoffs have you had in the last 90 days?
On today's show, we have a surprisingly lively recap of SFAR 118 with Jason. And then we're joined by Dave Keyes, chairman of the NBAA Small Flight Department Committee.
I think what Roger somewhat put it best is that the safe departments are the ones that continue learning. And when you stop continue learning, that's when you're going to be unsafe. So if you're not having those conversations after a trip or when something happens or how can we do this better, that's a real red flag.
You're on 121.5, the emergency frequency.
Welcome to the 21.5 Show, a podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. Join Dylan and Max, both with experience in flight instruction, the airlines, and business aviation, as they talk to a variety of industry experts, share stories, and have a little fun along the way.
Back and better than ever.
Coming at you hot from my office.
It's the 21.5 Show, the podcast for professional pilots by two
semi-professional pilots.
Semi-professional, one bearded professional pilot.
Professional by definition.
That's right. Your facial hair situation is really impressive right now. Powerful quarantine beard.
Yes. I'm on a bit of a hiatus from my airline, if you will.
Now, did they ask you not to come back or was this something you chose?
It was voluntary. Okay. Half pay, no work. It's a good deal, okay. I think. Whatever.
Well, speaking of no work, a lot of news in the industry this week. Last time we chatted, we saw United make a big displacement bid. And then Delta also had a pretty grande displacement bid come out. So kind of, it seems like March was the beginning of all of this, a lot of the confusion. April, the new reality kind of set in, and now May, we're starting to see the ramifications of
it's coming on paper now.
Yeah.
So exactly. What does it mean? Translate to us when they come out with a displacement bid, they're going to displace 5,000 pilots. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, at the most basic level, it means that a displacement means that the status that you're currently in, you may no longer be able to hold. And so you're going to have to bid for something else.
So basically, if they said they had 100 777 captains
and
100 A330 captains, and then now they're only going to have 80. So 20 of those dudes are going to have to go somewhere else, which then assumably those are the most senior dudes that then are going to push the next guys down off of onto the Airbus, which then is going to ultimately push to the least senior captains, push them back to FO.
Yeah.
And then the bottom FOs are going to get pushed onto the street.
Exactly. A displacement bid, when it comes at scale, I think has much bigger ramifications than a regular vacancy bid because it can affect almost everybody. So it just cascades way down as more senior people can continually bump people out of their seat. So we wrote a blog post on this and there's been a lot of conversation. We've seen articles in the media and they say, Delta to lay off 5,000 or 7,000 or whatever. Those aren't really correct because a displacement does not mean a furlough. Now, oftentimes it means a furlough is coming, but it's important to keep in mind that just a straight up number of displacements doesn't mean number of furloughs.
But is there some sort of math? That if there's 5,000 displacements, does that mean there's going to be how many furloughs approximately?
I mean, so the way it's been explained to me is that the math is two displacements for a furlough. So a captain gets displaced to first officer, and then a first officer just gets displaced to furlough, right? So that took two. Now, I mean, we've talked about, and we wrote an article about this on our website, there's a scenario like at Delta where you could run it down seven displacements to get to a furlough. If you did like wide body captain goes to a different base, wide body captain goes to, and then he displaces a wide body captain into a wide body FO. And then, and I mean, so the more fleet types, I think, then the more displaces. I mean, it's so confusing. And we touched on this before, I think, but the most important thing is displacements doesn't equal furloughs. So we're going to have to wait and see what those numbers are going to be. That's one. Number two, all furloughs can't happen overnight. When American furloughed all, they furloughed 3,000 after 9/11. How long do you think it took them to get through that?
I don't know. 2 years?
Yeah. More than 2 years. Wow. It took for them to get that many guys off. Because think about how much training has to occur and everything else. So I don't think, you know, we're going to have 20,000 pilots with their hat in hand on October 1st, all, you know, hitting the market at the exact same time. But obviously it's a precursor of not good news, but I don't think you can take some of these news articles and stuff at face value that say, oh, you know, 7,000 displacements means 7,000 pilots are going to get laid off. So,
well, more fun.
Yeah. What a great way to start the show. Super positive.
Really upbeat. Yeah. Positive.
Well, no, here, did you see there was
hopefully
some,
no one swerved off the,
yeah, right,
exactly, the ditch here, off the,
through their phone out the window while they're commuting. There was some good news though. Flexjet kind of is recalling everybody, right, pulling airplanes out of storage. We've talked about this before, but it seems like business aviation is probably going to get a faster rebound.
Well, and other positive news too. Southwest is going from their current, so they were just over 4,000 flights a day. They cut it back to 1,400 flights. Mm-hmm. And in the start of June, they're going to start ramping up the amount of flights. And the latest number I saw is by the end of June, it's going to be 2,900 flights. So that's a significant increase.
Yeah.
And for big 121 carriers. So that's,
yeah, TSA numbers are going up.
Obviously, their exposure is less because they don't have any of the long haul international and everything else, which we all know. But
yeah,
still, positive news is positive news.
So we'll take that. So we mentioned a few of these blog articles. We've been writing them on the website. So we've kind of changed our tactic there to kind of put some informative articles up there. We wrote one on our 401k stuff. We wrote one on furlough math and displacement math. We kind of run through it. So if you want to get some more information on that, you can check out the 21.5podcast.com website.
Most importantly, you need to sign up so those newsletters get emailed to you automatically.
Well, I was just gonna, list. Yeah, I was just going to talk about the newsletters. Our mailbag is kind of empty today. So I know. So we don't have any listener emails to read.
I could talk today about some of the comments I've gotten on my facial hair.
We'll get into that next.
Stay tuned for that.
Patchy is the word there, I would say.
Listen, there's not many times as a professional pilot that you can grow a full beard.
Yeah.
So I true. Figured
this is it.
I had a little time off.
If not when, if not now, when, right?
That's it.
But yeah, the newsletter. So the mailbag's empty, but the outgoing mail is full. We just sent out our second volume of the newsletter. If you haven't had a chance, you can visit the website and sign up for that. A lot of good articles in there, information. We've outlined some bullet point steps. Hey, you know, furlough might be coming. Here's some things you should do, or some tips. My wife has been writing some really good articles. She is a medical professional, and she's been writing some articles for pilots about how they can stay safe and healthy on the road, supplements they can pack with them and take. So a lot of good content in there. Okay, we got a pretty interesting episode today. And at face value, you might think, could be kind of a snoozer, but we're talking about that SFAR 118 that came out, the updates that Jason called in, and there was quite a few laughs in there. We made it as funny and entertaining as we could.
Trying to keep in the regs lively. It's
so best we can do. I would tell you, we make a lot of jokes, tell a lot of stories along the way. So I actually think you'll enjoy that segment. We're not going to go too deep into the regs, but just going to give you an idea of the new changes that are out. And then we had a really good conversation with David Keyes, who's the chairman of the NBAA Small Flight Department Committee. You know, we were both in small flight departments.
So. Yeah, we threw that around back and forth, especially when I was flying in business aviation forever, about all the different things that we wish we could do as a small flight department that we didn't have the opportunity just because of the scale. So
yeah, and I think it'll be really enlightening too, especially for airline pilots who might be looking to jump into business aviation for a little while, I think that's a really good conversation for you to kind of reorient yourself with some of the issues that are going on there, because the majority of business aviation operators are small flight departments. So it's pretty relevant for a lot of operators.
And I think the small 91 flight department is the far end of the spectrum when you go from the airlines to that. But I also think that that's probably the best part of business aviation is being part of a small 91 flight department where you know everybody, and you know, especially if everyone's traveling for leisure. And
I think it will probably, I mean, this is just a total guess on my part, but I think it may not be as affected as other sectors of the industry.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Because people that can afford it are going to want their own airplanes to get around. So lots of great info and those conversations. So stick around for that. Before we get going, we definitely need to mention our buddies over at Harvey Watt, our longtime sponsors of the podcasts. Of course, you'll remember that they offer loss of medical license insurance. They also offer life insurance. Did you know about that, Max?
I did.
I actually got it for myself, and the process was super easy. And what I really like, no exclusions except for suicide, and even that is removed after a couple of years. So if you got your own GA airplane.
What did that guy used to say on the Hair Club for Men? We're not only.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
What was it?
I'm not only the president, I'm also a customer.
Customer, that's right.
Like that. No. Yeah, so there
we're
you go.
We're not only sponsored, we're also. That's who provides my loss of license insurance. So.
Yeah, it's great coverage, especially for pilots. Super easy to sign up. HarveyWatt.com for more information. All right, let's get this thing going. All right, Max, on the line with us today, we've got our buddy Jason. You'll remember him from our episode where we talked about the Aspen Airport Guide. Man, that seems like an completely different universe.
We were in a totally different solar system.
Yeah, but welcome back to the program, Jason.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Appreciate it.
Welcome.
So, Jason, a lot has happened since we talked to you last, and there's a ton of regulations that have been changing, and you're kind of in the middle of it a little bit. So we were hoping you might be able to give us a little update on what is going on with all of the regs. I can't keep track. I know probably a lot of professional pilots are struggling with it. Have you been able to track all this?
Yeah, so everything's coming out all at once. The regulatory side has been a little slow to react. But a week and a half ago, the FAA published in the Federal Register a new special federal aviation regulation called an SFAR, SFAR 118, which provides pretty extensive relief for certain operations and leaves other things to be desired, wishing we had a little bit more relief. But it exempts a lot of airmen from certain requirements in Part 61. And that's probably where the audience is most interested in.
Right. At a high level, can we hit some of the highlights of those changes?
Yeah, so I think it's important for folks to understand what an SFAR is. And for those that fly, coincidentally, Robinson R-22 or R-44 helicopters, those individuals may be more in the know because those helicopters have an SFAR specifically for recency and qualification. But an SFAR is typically pretty narrow in scope or duration. And so this SFAR is effective April 30th of 2020. And expires on March 31st of 2021. Most of the relief expires before that cutoff, but that date is the last bit of the SFAR 118. So the SFAR 118 exempts quite a bit of stuff. It primarily applies to individuals that have recency or certificates or events expiring sometime between March 1st of this year, 2020, and June 30th. Of 2020. And each part of the SFAR kind of breaks it down. But at a high level, one of the cool things that the SFAR did is if your medical expires between March 31st of 2020 and May 31st of 2020, your medical now automatically extends by regulation to June 30th of 2020 without any additional paperwork or effort on your part. So that is a regulatory change. However, the FAA notes in the SFAR that it does not extend Part 6153 of the regulation, which prohibits airmen from operating with a known medical deficiency. So if you have a known medical deficiency, your medical certificate still can't be exercised. But if you're in good health and fit to fly, any medical that expired from March 31st to May 31st is good all the way now up until the end of June.
I was hoping for a fourth class medical to be introduced, but I guess I'll have to wait on that one.
Boy, that'd be exciting.
I think they had a lot of public comments on that one. I think you have to express your support.
Yeah, I know. Next time we'll lead the charge. We've got a lot of listeners. I think we can make that happen. The fourth class. That'd be real suited.
I think
for me.
Only 21.5 listeners will be eligible.
Every doctor I go see goes, a fourth class would be good for you. So
yes,
gonna make that happen.
Someone functioning a little lower than the rest.
Yeah. So I have a question, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, Jason. This just kind of popped into my head, but are insurance companies going to go along with that?
Good question. So with all of this, it's important to check with your insurance broker or your insurance underwriter. However, now that it's codified in Title 14 of the Code of Federal Regulations, it's pretty likely that they will. But double check with your insurance broker or underwriter, because every policy and every underwriter looks at the risk a little differently. And we can get into this a little later, especially with international operations. The SFAR allows you to use these provisions internationally as long as it's not prohibited by a foreign country, but you have to have the SFAR with you, the actual copy of the SFAR with you when operating international. So there's a lot of different pieces of the puzzle here.
Well, does it say that in the reg that you have to, where does it say that you have to carry it, a copy of it?
Yeah, it actually talks about in the SFAR, buried within the 94-page PDF file, it talks about requiring the airmen to have the SFAR copy with them. It can be electronic, but you gotta
how could there be 94 pages for something that seems so simple? Can you explain that?
If I could explain it, I'd have a lot of answers. I'd have a lot of good answers.
We'll be selling the 94-page SFAR on our website if you need to carry that. It's embossed in leather.
We have a pocket edition coming to you.
What's interesting is that when you bring up the insurance stuff, is the medical, it basically, a lot of times we'll just say you have to have a certain class if it mentions it at all in there, which what they're extending is your class remains valid, right? But what is very common language is a simulator-based training event in the last 12 months. And so I'm sure you're going to talk about next how they've given some relief there. And I wonder how the insurance companies are going to deal with that if you're going past your 12 months on your simulator training, because that is just black and white.
Yeah, it definitely depends on your policy. And I think certain underwriters are more flexible than others. So I think each individual policy and policyholder is going to have to check with their situation. But at least from a regulatory perspective, a lot of this stuff is now codified. It's no longer what the FAA previously issued was a policy of non-enforcement, which is just, we're not going to catch you running the stoplight. We're just going to look the other way. So this is actually a regulatory extension. So if your aircraft insurance policy talks about holding a valid FAA medical certificate, you would now hold a valid FAA medical certificate until the end of June. However, I will caveat this. If throughout this entire SFAR, if you can find a way to maintain recency or currency or your medical certificate in accordance with just the normal Part 61, highly encouraged. It's way easier than trying to figure out the SFAR. So if you have the ability to go get your medical and not use the extension, certainly something worth looking into.
You know, in Phoenix, that really, from what I've heard, I haven't had to go get a medical, Max. I don't know if you have, but from our friends that have had to, they said it's pretty much business as usual.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's, but I don't know.
You can also get a haircut in Phoenix too, which is something we take for granted. So
hashtag humble brag.
So here in Southern California, you can't get a haircut, but you can certainly get a first class medical certificate.
Wow.
I can attest to that. So last week, I think it was a week and a half ago, I got a first class medical renewed, and it was super easy business as usual.
Did you get it denied based on your hairdo?
My AD was contemplating it, but he had a bigger beard than I did.
I can't access your ears to do the
pure fit, but right, you look terrible, and you only qualify for a third class. You go hang out with the old guys at the airport now.
I walked into the office with a face covering as recommended by the CDC, and my AME almost laughed me out of the building. You can wear that if you want, but I'm not.
Yeah, that's cute, son. Sit down.
Yeah.
The one thing my AME did say, though, is with this extension, don't be surprised if your AME's pretty busy at the end of June. He said that he was pretty open his schedule in April, and now it's starting to fill up and it's getting real busy. So the sooner the better.
Well, that was my next point. We've talked about simulator training. You know, I just happen to be due in August, but I feel like there's a lot of people that if they can push this training off right now, they're going to kind of shove it off to the summer. And my guess is a lot of the simulator training vendors are going to be super busy this summer, trying to get everybody in. So if you love the Midnight Sim, this could be your time.
This could be your moment.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about this too. So there's going to be this big rush on the sim, and then, but flight safety and the simulator vendors have laid off people and reduced their capacity at the same time. And it seems what we heard before, it's pretty much indiscriminate. They just said, here, we're just going to hack these guys no matter what program was busier than the other or whatever. And it sounds like it's already kind of a mess, right?
Yeah. Even senior instructors within respective programs too.
The thing that's most important when you go to training is to remember that when you're in class, you should always start every sentence with, well, in the airplane that you previously flew, and you should always relate that information so that everyone else in the class can benefit.
A lot of people won't get this, but that's a corporate, that's a flight safety CAE thing when you're a corporate pilot and you go to
the Learjet, we never turn the boost pumps on
for a new type rating. And there's always at least one dude, usually two or three, that relate everything about this new airplane you're learning to the old airplane they flew. And it just...
That no one else flew.
Or cares about.
And yeah, that no one else could care. In the Jetstar on the number three engine, when you'd start it, every single time, it's always that dude. So
this annoying. Year, though, I'm going to get back at him. I'm going to record it. That's probably against the policy, but then we can play it and we all laugh. All right. Well, anyways, getting back on track, what else is in that SFAR would be interesting to most pilots, Jason?
So this is where the SFAR kind of diverges a little bit. It gets a little complicated. Now, if you're a professional pilot and you're operating for compensation or higher under Part 91 in an operation that requires you to have at least a commercial or an ATP certificate, then the next part of the discussion will apply. However, if you're operating the airplane, perhaps your own airplane, with a certificate that only requires you to exercise private pilot privileges, there are some very narrow and strict requirements, specifically for COVID-19 relief type operations. So if you're operating professionally, you have a commercial pilot certificate or an ATP under Part 91, the next part applies. But if you're flying on your own in your own airplane, then big asterisk next to that, you need to check and make sure that the type of operation that you're conducting under a private privilege satisfies the SFAR. That being said, the good news is for pilots operating under 6158, which is pilot proficiency check for an aircraft requiring more than one crew member or is turbojet powered, or 6155, which is second in command qualifications for aircraft requiring more than one crew member. Those two provisions of the FAR now have a total of 3 grace months. So for 6155, which is second in command qualifications for airplanes that require more than one flight crew member, the FAA is allowing 2 additional grace months for completing all the requirements in 6155B. However, to qualify for the additional grace months, the pilot has to review all the information that they normally would under 6155B1. And then also, there's an additional requirement that the 3 takeoffs and landings to a full stop as sole manipulator of the controls in the aircraft that they intend to serve as second in command now has to be within the previous 180 days prior to serving as SIC in that aircraft. So just be sure to look at the calendar and make sure that you completely satisfy that regulation. If you go a step further and complete the entire 6155B familiarization tasks and flight experience it's really not much more. So if you can find a way to complete the rest of 6155B, which includes engine out procedures and maneuvering with an engine out and crew resource management training, then you'll be all set to go under 6155B and you wouldn't have to use the extension.
Cool. Does anyone have any good 6155 stories? No, like I was at the airport and they needed a guy at the last minute to go in.
I had a client once who he had a significant amount of G4 time in his logbook, but no G4 typewriting. And so I asked him a little bit about this G4 experience. And he said that he had a friend of his that needed a G4 co-pilot and he was a G3 co-pilot. So couldn't have been that much different.
It's not. That's the FAA's fault.
Turns out it's a totally different type rating. And
it is. It's so lame.
He never completed any 6155. I asked him, I said, did you have any passengers on board? He goes, oh yeah, first flight. We had passengers. He let me fly. It was great.
You know, it's funny. That's 100% more safe than a dude that gets off a 737-200 to go fly a 737 Max or NG, you know, or any of those models, because those are wildly different than a G4 to a G3. It's funny, but anyway.
I picked the wrong example. I think I poked the bear.
Yeah, you did. That's always irritated me to no end.
Back in the 80s, my dad was on the ramp in Teterboro. My dad's corporate pilot. And this guy walks out to the airplane and he opens the air stairs and only one person came out of the entire airplane. And it turned out that the captain of this operation couldn't find an SIC that day to relocate the airplane to Teterboro from a nearby airport. And he decided to fly the airplane, single pilot, in a G4 into Teterboro. Just happened to park next to an FAA inspector doing a CFI check ride.
No way. No, he's in the back. He's just in the lab. He'll be out in a minute.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
Single pilot G4.
There's a couple of stories, if you Google them, about a famous race car driver who did that and got busted.
Oh, like, that's who it was. I was just Googling it right now because I thought it was John Travolta for some reason.
No, it wasn't.
G2 or something, but
how
it was.
How dare you?
I know. Sorry. No. Sorry, Captain
Travolta. And here's the interesting thing, not to get legal on this again, but the insurance company, you can ask Tom about this. The underwriters will find any possible way to try to get out of the claim. This happened up in Santa Barbara. This was a couple of years back, but it's a pretty well-known accident. Have you guys heard about the Falcon in Santa Barbara?
I don't think so.
I think it was a Falcon 900. I have to go back and look, but a Falcon 900 landed in Santa Barbara and somehow overran the runway or went off the side of the runway. And it turned out that the SIC did not meet the insurance requirements for SIC for sim training, because he had been to sim training 14 months previous. Ooh. And the requirement was 12 months and they did not pay the claim.
That's funny, especially back then too, because it would have been probably fairly easy to get a one-time waiver for that, you know, a letter.
Totally.
Especially back then. Now it's a little more difficult, but
it was like 1.7 or 2 million in damage. It was significant. Oops.
Save that money on training, though. Anyways, getting back on track.
For those looking for relief under 6158, which is a PIC proficiency check for airplanes that require more than one flight crew member or it's turbojet powered, you will have an additional 2 grace months, so a total of 3 grace months for a 6158. That applies both under 6158A1 for those that are required to have the 6158 in type within the last 12 months, and then also those under 6158A2 for the last 24 months for anything that's turbojet powered or requires more than one crew member. However, to qualify for the additional 2 months of grace period, you must meet some additional requirements. And that is within the previous 3 calendar months before the month of the flight, you have to review all of the operational information on the specific type of airplane, similar to 6155. So all of the operational procedures, performance, limitations, flight manual, placards, markings, all that good stuff. And you must meet 6157, which is a recency of experience. We'll talk about this here in a bit, but 6157 also has some additional relief for instrument currency. And you're allowed to use both the instrument currency relief as part of the 6158 relief as well. So you can use both of those.
So are those extra grace months in that same span where it's basically if you're due between March and June, or do they talk about that?
Yeah. So depending on your grace month, which in this case, anything that falls between March and June of 2020, your additional grace months will move by 3 months to the right. So for example, if your base month is June of 2020, you would have until September of 2020 to complete your 6158. But once again, if there's some sort of simulator requirement in your insurance policy, be sure to check with your insurance folks.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're going to have to, we'll have to get Tom on the phone again and see what he says, Max.
Yeah, I will. That's interesting.
Just tackling this right now.
Yeah. So when it comes to recency of experience, one thing to note that is absent from the SFAR is there is no extension of your takeoff and landing currency, which is codified in 6157. So unless you're part of a Part 125 operation, which is a corporate shuttle type of operation, there is no extension for three takeoffs and landings within the previous 90 days. So that's just something to note that that does not exist in the SFAR. However, the FAA did find that instrument currency needed some extension. And so they extended the provisions of 6157 subpart C, which talks about instrument currency. So the instrument currency is normally six calendar months. So within the preceding six calendar months, you have to do six approaches, holding and holding tasks and tracking and navigating, intercepting courses, et cetera. So that is extended an additional three calendar months, so a total of nine calendar months, as long as in the past six calendar months, you have logged three instrument approaches in actual or simulated conditions. So the requirements to qualify for this recency are a bit unique, and this is probably one of the most confusing parts of the SFAR. But as long as you have logged three instrument approaches in actual or simulated conditions, then you can take advantage of the relief.
This reminds me of another shirt we're going to be making that just says, fly what you can and log what you need. Fully sanctioned by the FAA. That is, I'm glad you're here to break that down because that is confusing.
And yeah,
you can tell the intent of the SFAR is good. But the nitty gritty of it, it is really confusing. And I think the lesson is you got to sit down and really study this a little bit and pay attention to see how this is going to apply to you.
Absolutely. And like I said earlier, if you can find a way to maintain currency or recency or medical certification, just like you normally do without the SFAR, highly recommended.
Just do that. It'll
probably save you some brain cells and you won't have to buy the new t-shirt.
You know, it's funny, all these regs and recency and stuff. I remember when I was a flight instructor and we talk about landing currency, right? And you go through that stuff with a guy and I go, okay, so let me just ask you one question about this. Is it possible to log nighttime, land with passengers and not be night current and that be legal?
And the answer was?
Yeah, it is, because you can start logging nighttime at the start of evening civil twilight, right?
Yep.
But then there's the 1 hour after sunset for night landings. And so there's the whole, you know.
Max was a real dick as a check airman.
I want to change this. A lot of people don't realize the recency also requires night takeoffs. So I think we should change this to ask, are you takeoff current?
That's good. Yeah. Takeoffs and landings is what it says. That's very true.
That's right. Are you night takeoff current?
We've got so many shirts we need to make.
Are you night takeoff current? I like that one.
That'd be a great opening line for Bumble. I think that maybe that's where you go.
How many night takeoffs have you had in the last 90 days?
Too much.
Jason, can you talk a little bit about how this SFAR came about? You know, you're involved with NBAA. How do the different industry groups work with the FAA to get this out? Did you guys have any input in it? Like, how did that all work?
Yeah, so a lot of the aviation associations, NBAA included, as well as AOPA and some of the others, petitioned the FAA for rulemaking. And fortunately, they came through. It took a little while. But as a lot of listeners will note, most of the relief came first to the commercial operators through the form of exemption for Part 121 or 135 certificate holders, Part 119 certificate holders. The challenge with that is if the FAA went down that route, every individual operator would have to apply for and receive an exemption and go through the entire exemption process, which is extensive, to say the least. So the FAA found that the easiest way to move forward in providing the relief to as many individuals as possible and entities as possible that were operating outside of a Part 119 certificate holder was to go down the SFAR route. And so all of the associations petitioned the FAA for rulemaking, and they provided their input. Some of the input was taken, some was not considered, or considered perhaps for a later date. But that's how the SFAR came about. There's a lot of great industry resources out there. This is a really difficult document to parse and interpret. And so AOPA has some really great flowcharts. So we can include that link in the show notes, and you can see all the different situations that you may need to consider. And then MBAA also hosted a really great webinar with two representatives from the FAA that helped write this SFAR last week, and they were able to answer some questions straight from the horse's mouth, if you will.
Mm. Yeah, that's what do you think? Do you think there'll be more follow-up SFARs or potential extensions? Did you hear anything about conversations like they're going to continue to kind of make decisions on the fly as things develop, or what do you think?
I think it's certainly possible. You know, this SFAR was fast-tracked. Normally, something like this would be posted to the Federal Register and go through public comment and all that process. But in this case, they found that just in the interest of aviation safety and public benefit, that they wanted to push this through as quickly as possible. But it wouldn't surprise me if there's maybe a change to it, or some additions to it, or extensions, depending on how things progress with the recovery from the COVID pandemic.
Right. Hey, one more question for you. We've seen a lot of confusion about this online. I saw something, and I honestly don't know a ton about it, but there was something about the standardization of 135 training. And I saw some confusion, pilots online thinking, oh, this is great. I can work for 135 carrier and then contract for another. Do you know anything about the standardization of training and how that really works?
Yeah. So the FAA recently released Advisory Circular 142-1, which contains a pretty good breakdown of what the FAA and industry work together to come up with, which is a standardized curriculum, which helps optimize and increase efficiency in the approval process and the training delivered between the Part 142 centers and also the Part 135 certificate holders. And so it will be, in theory, well, way quicker to approve Czech airmen, and also to have a lot of these training programs pre-approved. Because right now, every Part 135 training program is approved by the FAA, which takes a lot of time and oversight on their behalf. And so in this case, it will allow a pretty standardized curriculum for Part 135 training for each specific aircraft type to be almost pre-approved, if you will, and available for the POI's review, but pretty much already has the FAA's stamp of approval. So I would dig through the advisory circular. It's a pretty short read, but it does a pretty good job of explaining what the goals of the project were.
Okay, got it.
Interesting.
But it's probably not going to let people just jump around and contract from certificate to certificate.
No, that's not my understanding. That was the FAA's position in the past, but that position, yeah, I think, has long been sunset. You will find the FAA's existing policy of credit for previous experience, depending on the Part 135 certificate holder's FAA-approved training program, but probably won't find any information moving forward or even in the immediate past about credit for previous training. Only credit for previous experience.
No way to make extra money, Dylan.
But you were thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm looking at how can I get back into 135? That's something people weren't talking about a few months ago.
Another t-shirt. So,
well, Jason, we certainly appreciate your time coming in and breaking this down a little bit for us. We'll have the links to the SFAR and the resources that you mentioned from AOPA and NBAA in the show notes. And if folks have any questions for you, is there any way they can get a hold of you?
Absolutely. So private message through ProPilot World is the best way. You can sign up for ProPilotWorld.com. My username on there is Seriously, C-I-R-R-U-S-L-Y. Otherwise, you can pass all your questions to Max and Dylan. They can answer them, or they'll just pass them to me.
Do you want to give them your Tinder and Bumble handles as well?
It's for our premium listeners. That's the premium behind the paywall.
Those are for Patreons only.
That's right. Well, Jason, as always, we thank you so much for bringing your unique insight into a complicated world. So, and until next time, who knows? Maybe we'll see another SFAR or an extension or something. And we'll have to chat with you again.
Absolutely.
Max, I am so happy that we have made friends with Jason, because we really need somebody much smarter than us to be able to break all that down for us. So,
a real wizard with the regs, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. So we appreciate him putting the time into research that for us, and it's good number to have in your phone.
I think he does a good representation too, because he's a major airline pilot, but he'll still knows how to dive into the regs and talk about Aspen Airport procedures and all kinds of stuff that he does, which is cool. Help thwarting that stigma of the lazy airline pilot doesn't know anything anymore.
Yeah, exactly. With just that just grows a beard.
Just grows a beard and lays in the pool.
That's right. Okay, up next is our conversation with David Keyes.
Max, today joining us, we've got David Keyes. He's the chair of NBAA's Small Flight Department Committee. Welcome to the program, David.
Hi, glad to be here.
Welcome.
Can you start us off, David, by explaining what a small flight department is? I mean, is that something where pilots aren't over 6 foot tall, or it's just light airplanes under 12.5, or what exactly is that?
Yeah, it's a departments that are made up of dwarfs, and we have a special committee for them.
Fair representation, finally.
Exactly, it is. We define it as an operation or a department that has two airplanes or less. Originally, NBAA defined it as three airplanes or less, and we thought that three airplanes, you border on large flight department. So we define it as two airplanes or less, and we don't define how many pilots that includes. Our challenge is that it ranges anywhere from an owner-operator that flies a Cirrus up to a department that flies a Global 7500. Around the world with two pilots. So it makes it a little challenging.
So is there statistics on what percentage of NBAA members are single aircraft operators or considered small operators?
Okay. Yeah. We had them pull those numbers. 85% of the operating members of NBAA are small flight department. Yeah. About 2,500 flight departments that are members of NBAA are small flight department.
Dylan currently is, and that's what I was about a year ago. So lots of interesting challenges. We got some good questions, I think, for you, because we were just talking about it on the phone of all the challenges that of running a department like that, when sometimes it's great being small and gives you a lot of flexibility, but other times there's certainly some challenges that go along with that.
That's what we discovered. And I think I gave Dylan a little brief history that the committee did not exist up to about 4 years ago. And I kept wondering why there's no representation of small flight departments. And so I sent out an email and airmail and got a great response, and NBAA reached out and said, hey, you want to do this? And we did. So from that point to now, we've worked hard to kind of get our voice heard within the association and within the industry to represent small departments.
Yeah, I can imagine you want to pool the resources. You know, Max and I were talking about this just on one point, like an operating manual. You can't have 2,800 departments all trying to reinvent the same wheel. It seems like if we can get some common resources, we can really kind of get a lot of best practices shared.
Well, exactly. And the best practices exist within a lot of the resources already available. It's just making small department managers aware that they are there and how to adopt them. Of course, we keep rolling out new ones and working with IBAC and other associations to increase the level of safety within small flight departments. And one of our goals is how to operate a small flight department. A lot of managers don't have the management experience. And now you're managing a multi-million dollar piece of equipment with another pilot. And how do I budget? How do I order parts? What maintenance is due on it? Where do I go to find that information? So we're trying to develop systems that'll fill some of those gaps for them.
Yeah, I think that's really important, especially when it comes to the ops manual thing, because when I think a lot of these single airplane flight departments, a lot of them will be the same principle that you're flying most of the time. And the situation arises with weather or whatever, and you get starting to get that pressure from the principal, and you're not really sure how to deal with that. And you kind of just have to substantiate your position. You don't really have a book to fall back on of the ops manual. And so if you say, okay, this is great, I'll write an ops manual, and you present that to the principal, I think a lot of them will think, well, that's great. I'm sure you wrote this so it's in your best interest, maybe not his. And so it would be cool if there was a common one where you could say, look, here's the ops manual that most of the small flight departments in the country are running off of, including, you know, my five buddies here at Scottsdale or wherever you are. And that way everyone kind of has the same. So when we're all going to Telluride for President's Weekend with five jets and everybody's buddies who owns the jets, and two guys get in and the other three go to Montrose, you know, yes. It doesn't put everybody in a bad spot. And I think that would be really cool and enhance safety, because I think people make decisions in the moment that they wouldn't necessarily make if they had something that was already written out, not in the heat of the moment.
And what we tell folks is those conversations need to take place before you ever get in the cockpit. And that's where a lot of young and even middle people have been doing for a while don't understand that you need to have those conversations with the principal in his office or in having a cup of coffee to say, this is what we're going to operate. And this is, I've used this line for everybody's line. And every boss I've ever worked for, I said, you know, I like you. You pay me well. I love me. I make decisions that are going to keep me safe. You get the benefit from that, because you don't want to arrive at your destination dead. And I want to go home tonight. And I have that conversation either right after the interview or during the interview or very shortly, and say, this is how I operate. If that's fine with you, then great. And a lot of young guys I've shared that, you know, I'm going to use that.
It's funny because I've always looked at it. The general counsel and the chief pilot are kind of two of the people that you pay to tell you no. You know, a lot of people on the payroll, you want them to say yes, but you really need that honest answer from those two people.
Yeah, it's tough when you have to tell the guy no that writes your check almost personally. Right. It's, you know, in a lot of situations. And so depending on the personality on either side, sometimes it's not as difficult to manage that relationship. And sometimes it can be really hard depending on who you're dealing with and how big of a backbone the pilot has and how aggressive the principal is, you know. So that would be a great resource. Another thing that Dylan and I have always talked about is it's really a hard thing. Let's say you're working for a company. The last company I worked for, it was like over 400 employees worldwide. And so, and we were just employees of that company like anybody else. And so the benefits and 401k and stuff were consummate with everybody else, which made it very hard to compete because you had other flight departments and business aviation. And then of course the airlines that had more pilot benefits. You'd have management companies a lot of times, and then the airlines that the airlines kind of set the bar, I would say, up here with benefits. And then you have management companies to up retention or raising 401ks and benefits. And then you leave these small flight departments that are kind of attached to the rest of the group with inferior benefits as compared to everybody else. So we've always talked about if there was a way to have, you know, a sponsored NBAA plan or something like that, that everybody, these smaller departments could all buy into and have something that was more on par with the rest of the pilots. Is there anything like that in the works or been discussed?
Well, I think that we have discussed it, and we're kind of slowly moving in some direction. The pilot survey is probably the best tool that's out there right now that we have access to within the association to use with your principal. It's obviously market driven. You know, for the last couple of years, I've had a lot of pilots that you could negotiate. You were in the driver's seat because the airlines are sucking everybody up. After COVID, who knows, you know, that may go away, but I've never found, or I've always advised somebody, it doesn't hurt to sit down and negotiate. Most of the principals are, that's what they do for a living. They negotiate contracts for businesses for millions and millions of dollars. So to sit across the table from a pilot who has armed himself with data and to negotiate a contract is fairly, we don't do it, but it really makes a difference down the road, because if you just accept what they give you, you're in trouble.
Sure. And I don't disagree. But the problem is you sit down with the principal. He goes, look, I was in this situation personally. He goes, look, I'd love to give you more for your 401k contribution. I can't. We're limited by the plan that we have. I can't just give you more, not because he doesn't want to or because he doesn't want to hurt everyone's feelings. You just physically can't do that unless you have you just can't do that unless there is a executive compensation plan, which they have at a lot of companies where the executives right. are in a different, you know, if you don't have that or you can't get on the executive plan, you're stuck. And the principal is like, I can pay you more, but then it's not necessarily always advantageous, as we talked about in our last episode, to be utilizing taxed dollars versus a 401k pre-tax contribution. And it kind of backs you into a corner. And the same with healthcare. It's just, they can't make a plan just for you. So
it's a tough, I think what we've been hoping for, and what I think I would love to advocate, is there isn't going to be one solution that's going to fit this for every operator. But I think it would be cool if there was some way where we could work with some experts in, you know, I know there are 401k laws, there's a bunch of different laws involved in it, but maybe you develop three or four different models that you could present to operators and say, hey, if you're structured this way, this may be a way to help get compensation and benefits in line, you know, around the way that you have things structured. Now, it's funny we're having this conversation now when the majority of the negotiating leverage from pilots is kind of gone, but we'll be back there at some point again. And I just think it'd be interesting. There isn't going to be a one size fits all answer, but it would be cool if we had some different resources for different structures.
Part of what we face is it's tough with a single pilot CJ2 yep. operation is going to have a different negotiation than my friend with the Global Express mm-hmm. that does worldwide flight. Those are different conversations. The numbers are completely different. And there are, I think part of it is educating the pilot community as to what you can ask for. Bonuses mm-hmm. are certainly an option on the table to say, look, I know you can't, this is what the marketplace is bearing. And yeah, because of the company, but there doesn't stop you at the end of the year I expect this amount of bonus that I can defer into tax savings for retirement. So there's options, and it's just a matter mm-hmm. of educating. And we're working on that. One of the biggest feedbacks we get from departments is they want to be educated on the budgeting and the financial side so they can learn how the language of the financial people. Because you go into to negotiate and you're talking pilot talk and they're talking finance and accounting talk, and they're not meeting.
And that's what a savvy aviation manager does, because as Dylan and I have said, there's only one reason that we both don't have G650s. Only one. It comes down to the money. So that's how you protect your job, is to justify your existence and also to run an efficient operation. That's the only control that you have a lot of times over your job security.
Exactly.
When we were talking earlier, Dave, you had mentioned that an issue the small flight departments had was you were getting a lot of inexperienced managers coming in to take over departments simply because of the pilot shortage. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the professional development stuff you guys were looking at?
Right. And that's what we've seen because of the last couple of years with the retirements and the airlines hiring, that we get a call and the fellow would go, you know, I got hired 6 months ago. I got 1800 hours or 1500 hours. I was hired as an SIC and I'm now the chief pilot because the chief pilot got hired at the airlines. And now I have no idea what I'm doing. They want a budget. They want what maintenance is doing on the airplane. I don't know what to do. So where our committee has been working over the last couple of years to roll out some resources, and part of it's an LMS that they can sign up for through MBAA that's free, that would have modules on, hey, how to put a budget together. We're talking to the maintenance committee about, you know, what should a flight department manager, because I don't have a mechanic on my payroll. So I have to know how to read a camp's run or look at what's due on there, and how far can I fly over this particular item that's due. And so I don't know. I have to go find that out. So we're working with other committees to develop resources for flight department managers so that they they can get the knowledge. And ideally, our goal was to create a training program so at the end, they could actually sit down and probably take the CAM exam with confidence that they could pass it, because it's going to equip them with all the knowledge they need to for running their department.
That's cool. Do you guys do something to bridge the gap, you know, between there and the CAM? Because a lot of times the CAM takes a long enough time. And like you said, someone might be thrown into that job and needs a little bit of a jumpstart. The other thing, too, we've always talked about that is kind of puts you at a disadvantage if you're a smaller flight department is training costs and insurance. Whereas management companies are able to band together multiple airplanes and get better rates on both of those things. Is there anything that's being discussed to help those smaller operators to kind of band together or get on a group policy, say, hey, all the guys in Arizona can be on this one policy if you only have one airplane or something like that?
We have talked about that, but we've not been able to actually nail anything down. And actually, I just got off a call a little bit ago with our staff liaison at MEAA about insurance. And we've had a lot of feedback because of the increases lately and what can we do? And so we're trying to reach out through our members that are lawyers in the insurance industry to find out, is there something? The problem you run into is unless you put the airplane in a management contract, there's no commonality. It's hard to, for an insurance company to bridge 10 airplanes together under a common umbrella if there's no commonality. So figuring out what that commonality is going to be the hard part.
That's funny. You might be able to loop that back to our original question about the operations manual of kind of looping guys together. But I guess, I don't know. I don't think your management company members would be would be thrilled. So who knows? But that was always the thing, you know.
Yeah, and you have 2,500 individual operations that are all going to doing something the way they do it. And so it's like, how do you... will we ever get them all doing it the same way? I doubt it. That's a, you know, not going to, I would look at an airline. I mean, how many pilots you fly with and they always do it just a little different.
Yeah. Would be tough. I found the only thing that the greatest success for all the small flight departments is probably the CAA fuel program, right? Like everybody does it and it's just an incentivized money thing. And obviously there's not really any regulation.
Well, there, so that's interesting really too. They were talking about doing a similar thing with training at CAA. So who knows?
Yeah. Right. It just seems like tough.
You're right, though. That is the single best instance of everybody from all walks. Yeah. But like I said, banding all those guys together for insurance has to be the purpose of the reduction in rates, is because you're spreading your risk amongst everybody that is has a more of a measurable risk because you're doing things the same way with an operations manual and things like that. So,
yeah,
tough problems.
Exactly.
But like anything else, money is the ultimate motivator. So if the cost savings are there, people will probably, you know, if they said, hey, here's the small flight department ops manual, you use this and you're going to save X amount in training every year and X amount in insurance every year, you know, probably a lot of people would be motivated to do that, you know, especially in this time where, you know, I would imagine more flight departments are under scrutiny for budget items and things like that.
Yeah. And I think that conversation is going to be a little more valid going forward. And I was sharing with Dylan, our focus right now is safety. Single small flight departments have had a horrible safety record over the last 3 years. And we're trying to put our finger on what's going on. And so we've been in conversation with the NTSB about gathering data on these flight departments that have had incidents and accidents. You know, do they have an ops manual? Do they have an SMS program? And gathering some data and then figuring out how do we have conversations with 2,500 single flight departments about increasing their safety awareness or implementing some programs that will equip them to fly safer. That's why our insurance rates are up. The large flight departments aren't having accidents and incidents. It's all the small flight departments that are doing either inexperienced or dumb things or for whatever reason. And that's our focus really this year has been it's kind of our stated main focus for this year.
That's really good. Yeah. I was just going to ask you like the main objective for this year, and that does make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And like you were sharing with less experienced people in the cockpit, it'll be interesting. I mean, but what a crazy tilt to this whole thing the last couple months are providing. It's going to be really interesting to see if things kick back into gear in the next month or two. We're recording this at the end of April in 2020. The fall, are we still going to have a pilot shortage? You know, it's going to be tough.
I've been the last couple of weeks. I've been trying to get my a sense of small department health. I've been able to identify probably a handful in my contacts that have parked their airplanes and furloughed their pilots. The majority seem to be holding on. A lot of them are several of them have been assigned other duties, and they've been happy to do them, either work in a call center for a bank, or one group's putting circuit boards together for a manufacturing company on the West Coast. Everybody I've talked to in the last 3 or 4 days have said they're seeing more flying popping on their schedule. So I think we're going to know here pretty shortly who's going to survive and who's not in the corporate or the business end. I think the airlines are going for a tough road for the next couple of years.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think everyone is kind of still holding their breath, but everyone's kind of running out of breath before they got to either do something or go about kind of business, start ramping business as usual.
Yeah. And you could definitely see the argument of a lot of the smaller flight departments. If cost isn't the issue, I mean, the benefit of having your own airplane right now is just huge, I think,
right,
in for a while. So it's going to be, hopefully, business aviation will be in a good spot for a while. Yeah,
I know the guy that I used to fly for, I'm still friends with, and I was talking to him last week, and he's just chomping at the bit to use his jet. Because he goes, gas is so cheap right now, and I can't go anywhere. It's driving him crazy, and he is cooped up in his house, and he's pent up to go travel. So hopefully that sentiment is mirrored across the industry, because I think that would be very healthy for things if everyone's, you know, jonesing to use their jet.
Yeah, my friends in South Florida in the charter market say their phones are beginning to ring off the hook, that they're getting a lot of inquiries. So I think that's a good sign.
I think we're reaching a boiling point because everybody's tired of this. You know, everyone at first it was like, oh yeah, we're just staying at home and hanging out, and now everyone's
I clean the garage, this is great.
Yeah, now what? Homeschool is not so awesome anymore, and
yeah, I'm tired of my children, I need to go fly, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. You said it.
That's right. David, have you guys seen anything about retired airline pilots coming in and managing or flying in small flight departments? Has that been something the committee's come across at all? Or are people talking about that?
Well, I'll take two approaches. Yes, we have. We have, last year we had a lengthy conversation about putting together a program for retired airline pilots, kind of an intro into business aviation. That's still on the table. We just, with everything else, we haven't gotten back to it to say, look, you know, you've not had to schlep bags and take care of dogs and vacuum the airplane, you know, for the last 30 years. We want to tell you what this industry is about and how to be successful in it. Because we really felt with the shortage that would be the next impasse for you know, getting pilots into qualified pilots into the seats of small flight departments. So we're still working on that. I think there's some hesitation because the pushback is that a lot of these folks will come in and work for less than market because they have a retirement. And so that's part of the education process to say, you don't need to, number one, you have a lot of qualification. Don't sell yourself short because you ruin it for the rest of the industry.
Yeah.
It's kind of like my policy over the years. I've never do contract flying unless somebody calls me and I say, have you called everybody that does this for a living? And they're not available. Because if I get a paycheck every week, why would I take money away from a guy who that's what his job is to do contract flying? And we need to bring some ethics into it. And we're trying to educate those airline guys to say, don't come in and undercut the market just because you want to get out of the house.
That's smart. That's more of even just an awareness. I bet a lot of people take contract gigs that have no idea that they're cutting in front of somebody that whose full-time job that is. It's an independent contractor. So I think not only just pressing the ethics, but bringing awareness to that, because I can tell you I've taken jobs and hadn't considered the fact that there might be a dude that pays his mortgage on those exclusively. So,
right.
Contract pilots, that's a whole different episode. Yeah, there's a lot of contract pilots out there right now too. Yeah. I have a
feeling. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Which means, you know, even more so that if I get a call, I'd be like, no, there's enough of them on the street. Just put the word out. They'll contact you.
There you go.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. The
make sure that guy knows you want 20% when whoever gets it. Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
This not NBAA sanctioned transaction fee.
I'll take a free dinner. That's all right.
I like that. So yeah, I agree with you, David, on the retired airline pilot thing. Max and I have talked about it and looked at it, and I just think that pre this entire illness 19 thing, there was going to be a lot of retired airline pilots coming into the market, and frankly, business aviation was probably going to need them because right. We were losing a lot of the younger pilots to that. So the education, I think, is the most important part. We've done episodes and talked to retired airline pilots that have gotten into it and how they were successful. You know, it's an attitude thing. So I think it'd be great if you guys were able to work on some of those materials.
Yeah. And that's, we had a whole, NBAA has a whole workforce initiative committee working. Joe D'Amato is heading that up internally. A lot of their outreach is to the flight schools to educate the Embry-Riddles and the flight FITs and that, those students, what business aviation is about. But that's a hard sell because the airlines are on campus every week recruiting, at least they were, you know, that may change. So we really felt that to fill the seats, we're going to have to look at the retired guys. And then what we found too, is interesting that we had a pretty good influx of regional guys that just got tired of the regional, weren't getting the flow through, just said, yeah, I'm tired of commuting for this money. And hey, I can go fly this Falcon back in my home base and have a pretty good life. So, yeah.
That was the exact path that Dylan and I took.
Yeah.
Dave, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, I've been a member of NBAA for a while. I'm in a small flight department, but I haven't really heard much about the small flight department committee. Is there a way I can join it, or is there an email list, or is it on the NBAA website, or what can I do to get a little bit more visibility into what you guys are up to?
Well, perfect. We try and get our word out. I post on LinkedIn, I post on airmail, and we try and educate folks. If they're interested, NBAA is always looking for volunteers. And you just go on the NBAA site and put volunteers, and an application will come up. There's, you know, well, you know, committees for everything, safety, maintenance, small flight department. We actually fall under the domestic operating committee, which is responsible for, well, the 125 operations and the 135 and the 91. So we fall under, Jason Herman is the chairman of that committee. And so we're a subcommittee of them. So if they're interested in joining, just fill out an application, shoot it. It comes to our staff liaison, Brian, and then I get it, and Jason will get it, and we'll take a look at it. If we don't have room on our committee, we'll find a place, like either somewhere on domestic ops, or maybe we'll find something else that might fit better for what they want to do. But
sure.
I think people that join NBAA don't realize the volunteer effort that goes into the association from the members. It's quite extensive. And most of the product you see coming out has been produced by volunteers. All of the IOC stuff, all the safety stuff, the safety committee. I mean, it's just amazing the information they put out. And it's all volunteers.
It was really eye-opening for me this year at base because Max and I were invited to participate in an event with the CAM committee. And I'll be honest, I've only been to base a couple times, but before that, I hadn't really taken advantage of a lot of the roundtable and a lot of the breakout sessions that you guys do at base. And that was like, wow, this is a huge value for attending these conferences, is getting all of those great committee and kind of that smaller group setting where you can kind of connect and get some more information. Do you guys do anything at base usually?
We do. A couple of years ago, we started the day before base. So it'll be Monday from right after the single pilot stand down. We go into the same room and we do what we call it SOS. It's a single or a small flight department operations symposium. And it's to, we bring speakers in on topics that the guys that manage or work for small flight departments need to know, the budgeting, the maintenance, the safety aspect, the communication. We had a guy, you talk about how to negotiate with your principal, and he spent 35 minutes teaching us how to have a conversation with the principal. And it's really good. Like he said, you have 6 seconds to make an impression. And right. Within that first 6 seconds, you're either going to win or lose. So make sure that you take advantage of that. And that just always stuck. And so we try and equip the managers through that symposium. It lasts till 5. I think we're going to have it till 5 this year. So it'll kick off around 1 to 5 and have, I think there's 5 sessions in there. So yeah, that's before base. And I think it's $25 registration fee to cover refreshments. And then throughout the symposium, we're involved in a lot of other conversations. We'll be part, like we participate in IBEX, because and I think I shared with you, we were the impetus to get IBEX to create a small flight department ISBAO certification or under their umbrella. So they just rolled that out this year, and we're excited. I think it still needs some fine tuning, and they had a beta test out in the West Coast, just the single airplane Gulfstream flight department, 2 pilots. So we're waiting to get feedback from them on how the process went. But the issue is, and you know this, in a small, you don't have the resources. Your time is tied up doing things. So to put together an ISBAO program is just time consuming. So what they've done is they've married up with some manual folks and they have an advisor, a mentee, that walks you through the process so that they're providing you the resources, they're providing you the expertise. So at the end, when the auditor comes in, it's like, oh, you've done everything because your advisor has walked you through the whole process. So it cleans it up for a small flight department where you don't have to have the resources. So we're excited about that because whether they go that route or not, we want small flight departments to start talking about safety so that we can turn this tide around.
Absolutely. I think that's great. And we had even talked to someone in the insurance market a few episodes ago, and he talked about it, that maybe being a vehicle to getting some discounts, getting that type of certification. But I think you bring up a great point, because at the end of the day, yeah, that'd be great for a lot of small flight departments to do, but where that stacks in the order of priority of all the many other things you got to tackle, that might not be the highest priority. So if there are shortcuts and ways to kind of, or not shortcuts so much as just ways to aid you in doing that, I think that's really valuable.
Well, exactly. It was on a call the other day to talk. We have a subcommittee put together to kind of steer the safety conversation. And we're partnering with the NBAA safety committee, and they're on board 100%. So we're excited about that. But I asked the folks on my call, I said, if I were to ask you, what are the areas or what are the holdback to safety for small flight departments, give me in 1 or 2 words. And I thought they captured it very well. And I'll just give you a couple of them. We're too busy. We're trying to do it. We got 10 balls in the air and we just don't have time to catch that other one. Culture came up. If you're not creating a safety culture, then you're not going to be safe. If it's just, hey, this is the way we do it, and we're not going to talk about it when we mess up, we're just going to do it. And the other word I thought was good was integrity. And Roger Sumwalt from the NTSB has been kind of plugged in a little bit with us and has provided us some information. And integrity is if you're a professional, and if you're not going to have the integrity to act like a professional, then you really need to look in the mirror. And so how do we get a department to that might need to look in the mirror and say, you know, what can we do to be safer? That's the challenge.
Especially, I think, and I've heard this all the time, it's just me and one other pilot. Mm-hmm. I don't need an ops manual. I don't need all this. It's just the two of us. I know what he's going to do. I know what she's going to do when we're, you know, and I think that's one of the main challenges I've seen at many of the small flight departments I've been at.
The fallacy in that, though, is you do have an ops manual. If you think about it, you've adopted the procedures the flight safety or CAE or SIMCOM have taught you. That's your ops manual. Mm-hmm. So you, instead of sitting and writing it down and saying, well, does that really work for us? You've just taken theirs and say, well, we make these call outs and this is how we operate the airplane and this is what we'll do. So you really do. So now it's just taking that next step to say, having the conversation, does this work for us? And if we were going to change something, what would we change and why? I think what Roger somewhat put it best is that the safety departments are the ones that continue learning. And when you stop, continue learning, that's when you're going to be unsafe. So if you're not having those conversations after a trip or something happens or how can we do this better, that's a real red flag.
Everyone needs to institute the Miller Lite debrief after the flight.
Exactly. Exactly. That should be mandatory.
It is a really good point. It is a good point, though. And it's tough. And that it would be nice if that process was a little bit more formalized, because there is a little bit of politics involved when you're flying with one other pilot of you want to make a debrief item or something like that. And saying it in a political way and being able to not hurt feelings, but I guess the attitude has to be there from both pilots of wanting that continual development in learning and professional development.
Right, right. Exactly. I know you're probably before you go, because we're in the midst of COVID, whether you want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that small flight departments have with the current COVID. I was on a webinar the other day with the maintenance folks, and of course, like they, you know, have your mechanic do this and have your mechanic do that. And I said, I sent him in a question and said, we don't have a mechanic. There's two of us and neither one of us are a mechanic. Small flight departments face those challenges that big departments don't have. I've been to a lot of airports. Our airplane spends a lot of time in Americus, Georgia, and there's nobody there. And so if I can't pick up the phone and have a mechanic down the road come over and do an inspection, or run the engines, I have to figure out what to do with that. And then we're all getting bombarded with how to sanitize our airplanes. And it's easy to fall into the trap without doing some research. And I know Textron sent out a notice on approved chemicals. And if you don't follow it, in our case, our airplane's still under warranty, then what do we void the warranty on the interior because we now have contracted with somebody to do it. So I think it's important for small flight department operators to not just stumble through this, but you have to give some thought to what are we doing? If the airplane hasn't flown in 2 weeks, what should I do? Who do I go to talk to? I just talked to a friend of mine yesterday that has a global down at Orlando, and they flipped to St. Augustine just to operate it. They said, yeah, we needed to get it out and fly it, just to make sure everything was working. So you have
$10,000 hamburger.
Exactly. You know, we've all done that. But so I caution small flight department managers and single pilot operators that airplanes, if we've been in this business for any length of time, you know, airplanes don't like to sit. And so you have to go out and pay attention to it and fire it up, tax it around, fly it if you can. And if you have questions, reach out. Reach out to MAA because we have resources. We have experts that we can connect you with. The ops group, Brian Kester and his group, will take emails and phone calls and direct it to wherever it needs to go to get the answer that you need.
Okay. Yeah, that's a really good point. I know that's something that we're doing. We're a little lucky that we have a maintenance team involved with our airplane, but I see a lot of operators right now, you're right, going, wait a minute, what do we need to do? What's a storage protocol? You know, a lot of those kind of things. I think a lot of the research has been done. I know I fly a Bombardier aircraft and they've sent out an advisory wire, kind of like what you're talking about. Here's the approved chemicals and here are what you can clean with. You'd be surprised how expensive that stuff is right now, if you can even find it.
Well, and that's it. We ordered the approved cleaning Textron put out, and I ordered it in March. I just got an email. They may ship it May 15th. So it's like...
Definitely, maybe. Yeah,
definitely. And,
So, David, let's say that we have, you know, out here in Scottsdale especially, we've got a lot of small flight departments, and let's say they've got an idea about something that they think can be improved or maybe something that they would love for the committee to provide or represent them on. What's the best way to send things to get to the attention of the committee?
The best way is ops at mbaa.gov I think it's net or com. That goes to Brian Kester. He's our staff liaison. Or just, just go on the website and find his information. And he shoots it directly to us. He's become a very good friend. So we work hand in hand together. If you have a question or a situation, and it doesn't need to come to us, but it needs to go to Reg or something, he can redirect that to the right people to make sure you get the right answer, and he'll follow up on it. My information is out on LinkedIn and airmail. I always sign in there, put in with my name, and it has my contact information. Anybody's welcome to reach out to me, and I can connect them to wherever it needs to go.
We'll have all that information on the website and in the show notes on this episode, so you can just scroll down and find all that.
The hard part is communicating with 2,600 different flight departments. It's just, it's a tough challenge. And so we're trying to build the community, and we're trying to communicate. And that's why we hope maybe you can join us and help us in that effort, because it really is the challenge.
It's one of the reasons Max and I actually started this podcast was that we were both at small flight departments, and the onus is really on you to continue your education. We both worked at the airlines previously. There's a lot more training that's required, and that you're just more exposed to a lot of training materials. And really, if you're at a small 91 operation, if you want to stick your head in the sand, you pretty much can. You can go to flight safety once a year or semi-flight or wherever, and you'll kind of get the basics like we talked about. But other than that, a lot of the regulatory stuff, it's all on you.
Right.
So that was one of the main reasons we started this to begin with.
Right. And I think I would encourage, if you are a small flight department, Matt, and you're not plugged into a BNCA magazine, an AIN, and their emails that come out daily or weekly and podcasts like this, then you're missing the current information that you really need to operate your department. And they're free.
Yeah. Unless you like keeping your head in the sand, but that's a big risk.
Exactly.
These days with the amount of changes, that's probably ADSB. What's that?
Oh, really? Yeah.
Why are those fighters here?
Exactly. That actually went further than I thought, but yeah,
it did.
It was a touch and go there for a bit.
All right, David, we like to end every episode with a good aviation story. I don't know if you've got anything funny or interesting that's happened in your very brief aviation career.
Exactly. Wow. I'll go back a few years. I flew for Eastern Airlines, if anybody remembers that operation. And I walked the picket line for them and watched it go away. But I was an FO on an Airbus out of New York, and we were doing a San Juan turn with a captain that was funny as all get out. And it was the middle of the night coming back to San Juan. I've told this story many times, speeches, and he was a character. But we used to have garbage bags. I don't think they do that anymore. And they were white on the outside and had silver foil on the inside. And you have to remember, back in those days, people smoked. So I think it was in case somebody put a cigarette into the bag and wouldn't catch on fire. But anyway, we take off out of San Juan. It's 10 o'clock at night. We're headed to New York in the middle of the night. And he's up there just real busy. And I'm like, what is he doing? He's taking these garbage bags and he's turning them inside out. I'm thinking, what in the heck? After about 15 minutes, he turns around, he hands me one, and he hands the co-pilot one, and he says, here, put this on your head. I'm like, all right. And so we put this on. So now you've got silver shining outside. He said, put your oxygen mask on and the smoke goggles. So we do all that. And he turns all the red lights on in the airplane. And he dings. Now, back then, you know, the flight attendants had a key to get in the cockpit. So he dings. And the senior and the junior always worked first class. So the junior girl, of course, whoever took care of the cockpit, it was a junior girl. So she comes up front and he turns around and he yells, ozone alert, ozone alert, prepare the airplane. And the door slammed shut. And he says, quick, take it all off. So we took it all off and we're sitting there. And about 3 minutes later, the door slams open and it's the senior, and we got our butts chewed out. He said, what did you do to her? She is scared to death. She's trying to figure out what an ozone alert is.
Oh, man.
I
love it.
That was a good one. The things we used to do back in those days, you could not do today. And the environment has completely changed. And it's now a much different atmosphere. Because I flew at Southwest for 6 months before I came back to this job. It was good, but it was like, oh, wow, a different atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. Now all you can do is show funny pictures on your phone.
Exactly. That's about it. Yeah. Needless to say, after that night, if we wanted coffee, I went back and got it because we weren't going to trust the senior.
You weren't getting anything else. Guys. Don't drink anything they give you. Well, I'll get you out on this, David. If you had one piece of advice to maybe give a new small flight department manager, maybe something like what you're sharing, that the senior pilot has moved on. It's a younger, not as experienced person taking the reins. Is there one piece of advice you'd give them when they get going?
Yeah, reach out to either departments around you or to us. There's tons of resources available, and we can steer you in lots of different directions. We have people that will be happy to walk you through and mentor you. Just know that it's a community. I mean, we're aviation is such a tight community that we like helping people. Don't feel like you're in it alone. And that's, if you belong to the association, then take advantage of it. So many guys don't.
That's really well said. Appreciate your time today, David. All your contact information will be on the website in the show notes. And I hope folks reach out and get involved. I'm excited to have a small flight department committee out there. There's so many of us, especially where I'm based, that it's great to know that we can have a voice with NBAA.
All right, that does it for this episode of the 21.5 Show.
Special thanks to everyone that joined us today. Of course, Jason and David Keys. And special thanks to my wife, Lindsay, who really is leading the charge on that newsletter we're putting out. So,
your wife, my sister.
That's right.
That's a exactly. Story for another day.
Of course. So check out the website to sign up for that. Of course, thanks to our friends at Harvey Watt, harveywatt.com, for all the insurance coverage for professional pilots. And Max, I see on the desk here, you've got your 21.5 podcast shirt from the merch store.
Yeah, I do. Still in the wrapper. I hate to admit, but...
I've been sporting mine around. I got the one that says demand more than meows and guard police.
You want to know what the most insulting merch purchase has been?
What?
My father went on and ordered a Straight Talk with Ted shirt.
Oh,
that's a real kick.
We've got to save up for our special NetJets buddy that we have and get him that NetJets crew meal shirt that we made.
But we're going to order it one size too small. So we just look like a horse.
Motivate him to go from 4 crew meals to 3.
It's in the contract.
Just because we should get one that says NetJets crew meal, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Check us out Instagram. It's at 21.5 Podcast. And if you want to send something into the mailbag, info@21.5podcast.com. We'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
And remember, flexibility
is the key to air power.
See you guys.
Black God.